Tonight is the first of three studies we're going to have in the book of Philippians. So if you have Bibles with you, perhaps you could turn to the book of Philippians. Philippians are people who lived in the town of Philippi. And Philippi was a town in northern Greece in ancient times. The writer of the book is a man called Paul, and the book is actually a letter. It's a letter which Paul wrote to the church in Philippi. Paul was the great early Christian missionary, and he was the one who took the gospel, the Christian message, out from Palestine into other parts, and he went on various missionary journeys. On what we call his second missionary journey, he went from Palestine out through Asia Minor, and then he came up here to the top of Asia Minor and went across into northern Greece. That was his first excursion into Europe. And in Philippi, he planted the first European church. Up until now, all the churches had been Asian. The Christians were always those of West Asia. And now we have the first European church. The stories concerning the beginnings of the church in Philippi are fairly well known. Paul came to Philippi and he saw a girl around the streets who was used by her owners because of her occult powers. She used to predict fortunes and do all sorts of other strange things. And the people who used her made a lot of money out of her. When Paul saw her, he took great pity on her. And by the power of God, he freed her from the evil spirit which had taken control of her. Now, as you can imagine, this didn't make Paul very popular with the girl's owners. And soon we find a riot followed. As a result of the riot, Paul and his offsider were put in jail for the night. And they had a very eventful time in jail. And the upshot of it all was that the jailer, and a few other people as well, came to believe in Jesus Christ. There were other people that Paul had met in Philippi, and these also became believers in Jesus Christ. And that was the start of the church in Philippi. In due course, after Paul had been to other places, he returned to his home base, and then he set out on his third missionary journey, once again travelling from the Mediterranean area up through Asia Minor. And again he came through Philippi as he moved up through here and then down to the bottom parts of Greece. And then, having completed his work there, he returned up through northern Greece again, revisited the church in Philippi. That's the third time now he's been there, and eventually got back to Jerusalem. However, when he got back to Jerusalem, he landed in more strife. It's not that Paul was a stirrer or a troublemaker or a rabble-rouser. It's just that people didn't like others becoming Christians. And when he got to Jerusalem, he found himself there in the midst of a riot. As a result, he was put in jail. From Jerusalem was later transferred to Caesarea, and he sat there for 2 years in Caesarea, the victim of gross injustice, as people played with political pressure groups and there was a certain amount of bribery going on. And in the end, Paul could stomach this injustice no longer. So he appealed to the emperor, which was his right. And as a result, he got a free trip to Rome. It again was a very eventful trip, but eventually he got to Rome. And in Rome, he was held in custody for 2 years, during which time he was hoping that his appeal would be heard. Now, it appears to us that that was the most likely time when Paul wrote this letter to the Philippians. That is the traditional viewpoint, one that has been held from very early times. However, we must make sure that we aren't too dogmatic on the point, because it nowhere says in the book of Philippians that he was actually in Rome. It says that he was imprisoned, but it doesn't say that he was in Rome. We know that Paul had imprisonments in various places. Not many of these are mentioned in the New Testament. But when Paul writes a letter to one of the other churches, he says that he was always in prison. And no doubt he was in prison in many places besides those that we read about in the Bible record. For example, Ephesus was a place where he was constantly in trouble. And it has often been suggested that he must have spent some imprisonments there, and possibly he wrote the letter from there. But all of that is conjecture, and as I say, we don't even know that he had any imprisonments there, and it would certainly seem to me that the most likely place from which he wrote the letter to the Philippians is, in fact, Rome. and repeatedly during the letter he refers to his imprisonment. What prompted the letter was a visit to Rome from a representative of the Philippian church. The people there had heard that Paul was imprisoned, so they sent him some money and no doubt food or clothing or other commodities to help him. I think we tend to take it for granted in the Western world that people in jail are going to get looked after. But when you compare conditions here with conditions in other countries, well, there's just no comparison whatever. I have been into a number of jails in Thailand, just as a visitor, but the conditions there are quite austere, to say the least. And the people inside rely very much upon the people outside for clothing and food and toothpaste and soap and some of the basic things you need in your day-to-day life, and of course a good square meal every now and again. I would imagine that that sort of thing was fairly common in the ancient world as well. And no doubt the people in Philippi felt they'd like to help Paul, so they sent along this representative with some money and goods for him in jail. And Paul wrote to thank them for the gift. Now if you can go to the end of Philippians, chapter 4, towards the end, you'll find that he thanks them for this and gives us the main purpose for which he wrote. We'll just read a few verses there, pick up in verse 14. He says, "It was kind of you to share my trouble. And you Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia," Macedonia is the northern part of Greece where Philippi was situated, "no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving, except you only, or even in Thessalonica. You sent me help once and again." This is a true partnership which the Christians in Philippi felt with Paul. Notice two words there. They shared his trouble in verse 14. They entered into partnership with him in verse 15. Those two words come from the same word in the Greek. We hear a lot today about sharing. Now by that, people generally mean that we share our experiences with other people. Christians sit around in a group and they talk to each other about what they have experienced of the Bible or of God's working in their lives. They share their experiences with other people. Now, that's quite good, as long as we understand that that is not what the Bible means when it talks about sharing. It's a different sort of sharing. It's not sharing around in the sense of passing a plate of biscuits around and sharing them out one to each person. It's sharing in the sense of having a central big soup bowl in the middle of the table and we all dip into the same bowl and take something out of it for ourselves. We share in something that is common to us all. Now that is the idea of sharing in the New Testament. And the word sharing or partnership or communion or joint participation, it's translated in many ways in the English. The idea is always this of sharing in something. In fact, I think you'll find that of the dozens of times it's mentioned, all except one refer to sharing together in a common cause. They shared with Paul in the gospel. They were committed to sharing with Paul. It was a partnership. In other words, they are not sharing in a superficial sense. It's not a sharing that says, well, I'm going to tell you how I feel and I'd like to just hear what other people feel. It's sharing in the sense that we are all committed to the same thing and it's going to involve hardship. It is a total commitment. Each of us is in it. And if one person doesn't pull his weight, he's not sharing properly. They were sharing with Paul in the gospel. Paul went out and preached in other places. They were back in Philippi. But their sense of partnership with him was such that even when he was in trouble, they put themselves out to help him. That was their involvement with him. That was their commitment to the work that they were in. And there's a great lack of commitment among Christians today. So many people join in something, and if they feel like doing it, they do it. And if they don't feel like doing it, well, they can't be bothered. The sense of total commitment to something is rather foreign to many. No element of sacrifice, no element of putting oneself out for the sake of someone else. A very loose attachment. And that's not a biblical idea. The biblical idea is a partnership, a commitment to something, sharing even in the troubles of another person. Paul is very thankful that these Philippians accept their responsibilities as a church totally, and the individuals within that church accept their responsibilities totally, and they demonstrate it by putting themselves out for the sake of Paul. So Paul's very thankful to have received their gift, but just in case any think that he's only concerned with receiving, he writes to them and says in verse 17, "Not that I seek the gift." Don't get the impression, he says, that all I want is just something that you give to me. Thank you very much. "I seek the fruit which increases to your credit." I'm very thankful for the gift, yes. But I'm even more thankful that you are the ones that are going to be rewarded by God for this. And those words at the end, "to your credit," are words that come from the world of banking. We put our money in the bank and we get interest, which is to our credit. He is saying this, that when people give to the service of God, even though they are giving, God takes note of it and he adds interest to their credit. Ultimately, God will not be any person's debtor. They will benefit. If, of course, we give simply hoping that God's going to load it onto us thickly, well, then we may find we're disappointed because we're giving from the wrong motives. But if we give totally, sacrificially, because it's part of our Christian duty, then God will certainly see that in due course we are rewarded, not necessarily with increased affluence in this life, but God in his way takes note of it. So in verse 18, Paul has received full payment and more, and he is filled, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts which they sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God. Notice it is a sacrifice. A sacrifice is something that costs you something. Christian giving, if it is Christian giving, has to be sacrificial giving. If we give of our cash or our time or our wherewithal in general, if we give only what's left over, or what we don't want ourselves, or what is convenient for us, there's not much sacrifice in that, is there? It's not costing us anything. And it's not Christian giving. It's not the sort of giving that God is going to take note of and reward. Paul says that their giving was a sacrifice. And because it was a sacrifice, God accepted it. And in due course he rewards. That's why in verse 19 you find, "My God will supply every need of yours according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus." That's a very well-known Christian quotation. You find it on texts stuck on walls and written in the front of books that we give to people as gifts. But I'm not sure that we're justified in using that verse the way we do. The promise is not given across the board to everybody. We don't have any right just to go to the Bible and to whip out any promise that we see there and claim that for ourselves. This promise is not given to any and every Christian everywhere. "My God will supply all your needs according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus." It is given to people who have themselves just given sacrificially. It's to those people that God gives the promise, "I will supply your needs." You have given sacrificially. God has accepted your offering, and you can rest assured that he will supply all your needs because you have helped to supply somebody else's need. God takes note of it, and so he will in due course supply your needs according to all his riches. And so you need have no fear. Now that section at the end is the main reason, you might say, for which Paul has written. But Paul is a preacher above everything else, and of course some preachers, once they get the chance to say anything, they make sure they say a lot. And that's what Paul's done here. He's written them not just half a dozen verses, but a whole four chapters. And we're going to go through those four chapters, and if we could go back to chapter 1, verse 1, we'll get our starting point. What I want to do tonight is to go through chapter 1 as far as verse 26. And then next week, we'll do the remaining part of chapter 1 plus chapter 2, and the final week, chapter 3 plus those sections of chapter 4 that we haven't looked at tonight. The letter starts with a greeting from Paul. The ancient writers put their name at the beginning. Paul and one of his offsiders, Timothy, send greetings to the people he's writing to, which of course is the church in Philippi. He mentions the bishops and deacons there. The bishops and deacons were the officials in charge of the church. not as sophisticated as we might imagine today. When we think of the word bishop or deacons, we think of a church dignitary dressed up in fancy garb. But these were just the leaders of the church, the bishops or elders or pastors or shepherds, whatever you like to call them. They had the responsibility for the spiritual oversight of things, and the deacons were those who helped relieve the elders of responsibilities, these in relation to the general running of things, so that the pastors, the elders, the bishops, had their time free to devote themselves to the spiritual care of the church. I imagine the reason Paul mentions these two sets of people in his introduction is that they had taken the initiative in prompting the church to send the gift, and for that reason he specially mentions them at the beginning. Verse 3 to verse 11 is a prayer of Paul's for the church in Philippi. Paul nearly always starts off his letters with a prayer. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but we'll look through it because there are some helpful things. He thanks God in verse 3 for every remembrance he has of them, which is quite encouraging. It's nice to be able to think that every time you think of a certain person, you thank God for them. I'm sure there are certain people whose names drop into our mind from time to time, and we aren't exactly filled with thanks when we remind ourselves of their existence. Maybe we can learn something from Paul here and adopt a more positive attitude to things. In verse 4, he always, in prayers, makes mention of them. So he's consistent in his prayer, and he's remembering these people before God. In verse 5, he expresses his thanks for their partnership. There it is again, the partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. Consistent commitment from the first day until now. It's one of the great themes that comes through the letter to the Philippians, this element of consistency. And that is what God is looking for in his people. People who are prepared to commit themselves to work and to maintain that right through. Some people get all enthused and they're okay for 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks, maybe even 2 or 3 months. And then it's left to the old faithful one or two to carry the burden as usual. Not Christian. The Christian way is the way that's presented for us here. A partnership from the first day, year after year after year, right up to the present. Verse 6 tells us that this same God who began the good work will bring it to completion in the day of Jesus Christ. The commitment which these people have showed, the consistency which they have demonstrated year after year, is the way to Christian maturity. Paul speaks a lot about Christian growth and Christian maturity, but there are no shortcuts. A person will never arrive at any goal of Christian maturity unless he has learnt this commitment in partnership in the work of God from the first day until now, year after year, moving on without opting out, without dropping the bundle, not being up and down the whole time. But this consistency is part of the pathway to Christian maturity. And so Paul ties the two together there in verses 5 and 6. And in verse 7, he says, it's right for me to feel thus about you because I hold you in my heart, for you are all partakers with me of the grace of God. Once again, that word partakers of the grace of God. Partnership in the gospel. Sharing in my troubles. The communion. This morning, many of you met in this building and worshipped God in the Holy Communion. Now that again is a sharing, it's a joint participation, it's a partnership. All of us participating in something. We all eat of the common elements, we all eat of the same bread, we all drink of wine, we do something together, we partake of Christ. And so it's that same word again, partaking with me of grace, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. He points out in verse 8 that he has a great longing for them. Then in verses 9 to 11, he moves through to come to the actual things he prays for in his prayer. And it is very instructive. Do you ever find that your prayers lose their edge? You get jaded, tired, bored, lazy, humdrum, same things being said, and you go round and round day after day. In fact, I think that many Christians have just about given up on prayer. It seems that of all aspects of the Christian life, that is the one that is most easily dropped. I read a report recently in a magazine It was an American magazine, and somebody had conducted a survey across a whole range of churches in one of the states of America, and they came up with the most startling revelation. People were apparently given a questionnaire of some sort, and it involved how long they prayed each day. And the astounding revelation was that the average time that each person spent in prayer each day was 2 minutes. And for pastors and ministers and the like, it was 4 minutes. That was pretty staggering. But I would challenge you, maybe over the next week, just look at your watch and just check how long you spend in prayer each day and ask yourself, is that really satisfactory? Some time ago, I decided to memorize the prayers of Paul because I found that they were helpful. And as I have memorized them and used them, I have found they have brought some fresh angles to my prayer life. The Lord's Prayer likewise. Memorize it and stop point after point and elaborate upon those points. Festoon out from them, embellish them. I'll show you what I mean. Look at verse 9. It is my prayer that your love may abound more and more. He is praying that people may abound more and more in love. Now just stop there and think of how you can work out from that point, praying for an increase in love in your own life or in the lives of people you're praying for. And think of the specific applications of this. And before you know where you are, you'll find that you're going off into all sorts of areas that you've never prayed for before. He goes on, with knowledge and all discernment. A lot of people are frightened of praying for knowledge. They're frightened of getting knowledge. Maybe they're frightened that if they know more, it may challenge some of the things they already believe and practice. Too often we rely upon our feelings and not enough on our knowledge and our discernment. If we are to grow in grace, it is only as we increase in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ, says Peter. Paul time and again talks about us increasing in the knowledge of God. If we don't know about God, if we don't know what sort of person God is, we will not be able to live our lives in a way which is in keeping with his character and the character that he wants to reproduce in us. We must increase in knowledge. We can stop there. And as we're praying for people and for ourselves, pray this prayer. And discernment. And think of the things in life where we need discernment. And Christians, I'm afraid, very often are lacking in discernment. Very gullible people at times, Christians. So easily led. Don't seem to be able to tell the difference between what is worthwhile and what is worthless. We can think of the different areas of our lives where we need to make decisions. Ask God's direction. Specifically name these things and ask for his discernment. So that in verse 10, we may approve what is excellent. The trouble is our standards slip. And we approve all sorts of things that are rubbish. Things that 5 years ago we would have condemned. We've been brainwashed, our standards have slipped, and we accept without question now things which some years ago we might have turned away from in disgust. Perhaps we haven't been applying ourselves to approving what is excellent. And there's another area of our prayers. This is an area of Paul's prayer. And I'm sure that if we prayed for these major things and let them filter through into the everyday issues of our lives, we'd find that our lives are more worthwhile. And perhaps we wouldn't be so hung up on all the little finicky, niggly things that sometimes upset us. Perhaps we wallow around too much in all the mud and murk of the minutiae of life, the little things. Instead of getting our mind on the bigger things, and once those bigger things are in right perspective, I think we'll find that so many of those smaller things look after themselves. And he goes on to say that he wants us to be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. There is a day coming when each of us will face Christ. There is a day of reckoning, yes, for the Christian. Christians too often think that there is no judgment, that everybody else faces judgment, but the Christian doesn't. Well, the Christian does face judgment. Maybe he doesn't face judgment for the condemnation of his sins. Maybe if he is trusting in the work of Jesus Christ for him, he can be assured of his forgiveness, and he may be confident that there will be no eternal condemnation to hell. But that does not mean to say that he is absolved from his responsibility. We are accountable. We will stand before Christ. And Paul wants us not to be ashamed when that time comes. He wants us to be pure and blameless. And in verse 11, in the meantime, filled with the fruits of righteousness, the truly Christian qualities being reproduced in our lives to the praise and glory of God. We come now to verse 12, and from verse 12 to verse 26, Paul speaks of the results of his imprisonment. Many in Philippi were upset. They felt that with Paul in jail, the bottom was falling out of things. Maybe the Christian world was coming unstuck. There was the greatest of all their apostles imprisoned in Rome, of all places. A man who can preach like Paul ought to be out in the streets and marketplaces preaching. And there he is, locked up. Paul says to them in verse 12, "Look, I want you to know that what has happened to me has actually fallen out to advance the gospel. Because I've been able to speak to many people here in jail that I would never have met otherwise. Jail keepers, warders, sweepers, cleaners, Roman officials, people coming and going, all sorts of people," he says. And as a result, in verse 13, "It has become known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to all the rest of the people around the place that my imprisonment is for Christ." They got the gospel. They knew why Paul was there, and he took the opportunity to tell them a few things about the good news of Jesus Christ. The Praetorian was originally the headquarters of the Roman army commander, whether in Rome or in one of the provinces, but later it became the residence and the administration center of the Roman governor, whether in Rome or in one of the provinces. You have a reference in the story of Jesus to Pilate taking Jesus into the Praetorium, which was the governor's residence and administrative offices in Jerusalem. That's just by the way. The result is in verse 14 that most of the brethren, that is the other Christians in Rome, have been made more confident in the Lord because of my imprisonment. They have seen the way Paul has acted, and instead of dropping their bundles, they've taken more heart. They have felt that, if Paul can stand like that and reach so many more people with the gospel, and some of them, we understand, became Christians. Maybe they said, if he can do that inside the jail, what more can we do outside, where we have this freedom? And so they were spurred on to greater efforts. They were much more bold to speak the word. Unfortunately, they were bold in different ways. Some had good motives and some bad. Did you know that we could preach the gospel of Jesus Christ out of bad motives? We can carry out our Christian work with bad motives, trying to get the upper hand on somebody else, trying to advance our own cause, insincere, making a show, but somehow using our religious service as a way of promoting ourselves, usually at the expense of someone else. Now that was what was happening in Rome. There were those in the church who were sincere. They were the majority. But there were the others there that were pleased to see Paul locked away, because they could then push their own claims, knowing that Paul could do nothing about it. He couldn't come out to the church and put them straight. He couldn't interfere. And so they pushed ahead, using Paul's absence as an excuse for furthering their own cause. Verse 15, "Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry," false motives. "Others from goodwill," sincere motives. "The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of partisanship." They're jealous of Paul. They're doing it not sincerely, thinking to afflict me in my punishment. They even take delight that Paul will get that great sense of frustration. There he is sitting away there, not able to move out into the open world outside, and he hears of the work of these opponents, and he can't do anything to stop them. And they take some sort of wicked delight in seeing the old man frustrated like that. Well, what's Paul's reaction to all this? Well, you wouldn't believe it. He says in verse 18, "What then? What'll I do? What's my reaction to all this? Only this, that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice." There's a noble character for you. He's not out to get square with these people. He says they might have the wrong motives, but, well, what's it matter? He said, at least it could be worse. I mean, they could be preaching some sort of heresy that they got from one of the religions round about, or they could be encouraging immorality, or could be doing all sorts of wrong things. But he said, at least they're preaching the gospel. They might be doing it from wrong motives, and they might be trying to cut me out, so to speak. But he said, at least they're preaching the gospel. And as long as they're doing that, well, I'll take whatever sort of flack they have to throw my way, and I'll rejoice in that at least Christ is being preached. There you have a true demonstration of what Christianity should be. Jesus said to us that if anybody hits you on one side of the face, you don't hit him back, you turn the other's cheek. That's what Paul has done here. No retaliation, but he at least sees that every cloud somewhere has got a silver lining, and it's our job to find it. And Paul's found it here, and he's found it in the fact that at least they're doing something for Christ, and he said, I'll rejoice in that. Yes, in verse 19, I shall continue to rejoice, because I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. He's confident. He says, you're praying for me, and I'm praying, and we're praying that I'm going to be delivered from this imprisonment, and I'm going to come to you again. And he is confident of the answer to prayer. And we can have a certain confidence as we pray. But Paul's confidence is tempered with a very healthy awareness of the fact that ultimately God is the one who's going to decide whether the prayer gets answered. Because he goes on to say, it's my eager expectation and hope that I shall not be ashamed, that is, I shall not fail when the test comes, if I stand before the emperor or whatever, but that with full courage now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. And he's not quite so certain now, you see. Perhaps he won't be acquitted. Perhaps he will suffer death. Perhaps he will get the chop. And he won't be released to come and see the Philippians again. He starts off in verse 19 by saying, I'm confident that through your prayers I'll come. But he finishes up at the end of verse 20 by saying, although, of course, I may get death. That is the balance that we've got to maintain in our prayers. Yes, we can have confidence. But no, we are not to presume that we can dictate for God what he must do. The final decision rests with him. Some people talk about prayer almost as if God is there at their beck and call. Ring the bell and God will do it for you. Paul is not like that. He knows there is a confidence that we can have when we bring our prayers to God, but he keeps the reservation in mind that God is sovereign. And although he's confident of release, he knows that there is still the possibility that God may choose otherwise. That leads him on to talk about life and death in verses 21 following. For me to live is Christ and to die is gain. So it doesn't matter whether I'm alive or dead. As far as I'm concerned, it's with Christ. If I live, well, I enjoy Christ more. If I die, I go to be with Christ and enjoy him more. So it doesn't make that much difference. If I live in the flesh, in verse 22, that means fruitful life for me. I can keep my Christian service going and I can enjoy what I'm doing. But what I choose, I can't quite tell. I don't know which of the two I would prefer, because in verse 23 he says, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that's far better. I'll be out of this prison, I would be free from all the hassles of life, I wouldn't have all these people who are getting at me in one way or another, I wouldn't have all this injustice heaped upon me, and to go and be with Christ would be far better. But verse 24, to remain in the flesh, to stay alive and keep on moving around in my Christian work, is more necessary on your account. Life benefits them. Death might benefit me, but life will benefit you. And when he considers all this, in verse 25, he comes back to his original conclusion that the most likely outcome is that he will be released, and then he will continue with them all for their progress and joy in the faith. And in verse 26, at the end of the verse, that he will come to see them again. Again, the balance. Certainly the Christian hope, the Christian's confidence, that which he looks forward to, is to be with Christ. But that is not some sort of means of escapism from the realities of the present. It's not good enough for Christians simply to shake their head at the troubles in the world and say, oh well, soon we'll be released from it and we'll all go to be with God and then it will all be peaceful and everything will be happy and harmonious from there on. Well, it will be happy and harmonious, but that is not to be used in some way to blind our eyes to the world we live in. Have you ever been at Bible discussions or talking with Christians and talk about the troubles in the world and this goes wrong and everything else has gone to pot and the politicians are bad and the weather's no good and we have personal problems and everything's just falling apart, and then somebody will say, oh well, it will all be okay in the glory and we'll be with the Lord then and it will all be past. And that apparently brings the discussion to a conclusion. Well, it doesn't. It may be true that when we're with Christ, those troubles have passed. But the Bible nowhere encourages this sort of escapism. We cannot opt out of the world we live in. Christianity is the most realistic of all religions. It's not just pie in the sky. It is down to earth, and nowhere does it promise the believer that he is going to sail through life with no troubles and hassles, that somehow he is going to have an extra special experience which is going to make him immune from the troubles of life. It nowhere says that. It nowhere offers slick solutions to the world's problems. It says you live in a world which is ruined through the effects of sin, and you've got to live here. Christ is not going to take it out of it simply for our own convenience. But what he says is this: in spite of the problems, the suffering, the mess, the disappointments, the frustrations, everything going wrong, through it all, I will be with you. I'll use those experiences to strengthen you. I'll teach you what it is to be a real Christian. And ultimately, I'll bring you into fellowship with myself in the world to come. And then you will look back on it all, and you will have greater enjoyment of the world to come then because of what you have learned in this life. But he is not going to use the world to come as an excuse for somehow evading the responsibilities which are before us in this world. It was when Paul had these very, very strong desires to be with Christ that he most severely brought himself down to earth with a thud by saying, but to remain in the flesh is more needful for you, and therefore I must take that responsibility first. And so he continues then, and he looks forward to the time when he's going to come back and see the Philippians, and he's going to work further for their progress and joy in the faith. And that is what Paul always is concerned with, the spiritual progress, the growth, the maturity of the Christians that he is dealing with. And that brings that section to a conclusion. Next week, we'll commence the second section, which begins at verse 27 and runs through to the end of chapter 2.